Hey, GeoTrekkers. Welcome to GeoTrek Podcast 94, Blindsided, the top 10 misunderstandings about hurricane impacts. We're expecting an extremely active hurricane season in the Atlantic Basin this year, and hurricane season officially starts less than 1 month from now. So as we prepare for this blockbuster hurricane season, I've wanted to do a podcast episode on these impacts from hurricanes that really blindside us or take us by surprise. Hurricanes are complex storms that really throw four separate hazards our way. There's the destructive winds, flooding from saltwater storm surge, flooding from heavy rain, and even some isolated tornadoes that can be spun up by hurricanes. Those are complex events that are always different from each other and can really blindside a lot of people. And so I've wanted to come along before we get into hurricane season and just talk about really 10 major misunderstandings that I've seen in my work professionally. So these insights come from academic training and working in the field of extreme weather and disaster communication for nearly 20 years. But I'll tell you what, a lot of these insights also come from spending a few weeks every year in disaster zones, especially hurricane impact zones. When I go into these zones, I go in with an empathetic heart. I'm trying to understand and engage with people. I do not go in with a critical eye. I'm not there to tell people you should have evacuated or you should have done this. I'm mostly there just to shut up and listen and learn. And I always call it going to school. I go to school for a week or two in these disaster zones. I'm there before the storm to forecast it. I'm there during the storm to video it and document what happened. But I usually stay in a major hurricane zone for at least a week afterwards to see what people need, but also to see what they've learned and understand their perspective. Where were they getting weather information from? How did they make decisions? Did they evacuate? If so, where did they go? Did they have that plan ahead of time, or was it very dynamic and fluid during the situation? These are all the things on the ground that I've been doing for years now. I've been documenting hurricanes since really like 1995, but more consistently since 2008. I've been in 18 hurricanes now. And again, each one is a learning time. I learn a lot, and I think we all learn as a society as well. Hey, if you're new to the podcast, GeoTrek explores the world, covering stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. We're really interested to understand the physical processes behind these extreme events, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of these events to reduce the loss of life and property. The cost of this podcast is free, but we do ask that you share it with anyone that you know that may be interested in hurricane science, living in a hurricane-prone area, or just really interested in disaster science as well. So without further introduction, we're going to go right into it. Again, this is a top 10 list of really the things that blindside us, or, you know, what I'm calling it here is the top 10 misunderstandings about hurricane impacts. Okay, y'all, let's jump to our list here. I'm ranking the number 10 misunderstanding of hurricane impacts is a perspective that the day of the storm is the biggest challenge. A lot of times people are looking at a hurricane making landfall on a Tuesday and they're like, if we can just make it through that day, we'll be fine. And they're really underestimating the long-term impacts, weeks to months, or even sometimes years, if it's a big enough strike, that can impact places. Did you know that a lot of times the indirect impact of a hurricane is actually more deadly and more devastating than the direct impact? So a direct impact would be a tree falls on a house because of strong winds, or storm surge floods a house because a storm surge is pushed on shore during landfall. But the indirect impacts can actually comprehensively be bigger than the direct impacts. Here are some examples of indirect impacts. Heat exhaustion. So you lose power for a period of time. And the day of the storm, actually, it's not that hot. It's windy and it's rainy. But then starting the day after the storm, the sun comes back. And all of a sudden, you don't have air conditioning. The temperature outside is 96. Inside your house, it's 106. And people getting sick or dying of heat exhaustion. Let's talk again about no electricity. Sometimes electricity can be out for weeks or even longer after a direct hurricane strike. The authorities, local authorities, can say there's a boil water notice. Do not drink the water because we haven't been able to purify it. Only use bottled water. And sometimes people run out of water, or they can't have a system to boil the water. What about you? The electricity comes back. You go to the grocery store and they say, hey, our system is still rebooting. We can't take cards today. Cash only. And you say, oh no, I got blindsided, right? I thought I'd be fine, but I only have $11 in cash. I can't get groceries. What about your grandma or your mom maybe who cannot get medication? So all of a sudden the storm hit, the pharmacy closed up and they're not open again. and your grandma or your mom only has 2 days of medication left for something really important. These are all things that can blindside us. We talked again about losing electricity. Sometimes people will have unventilated generators and be injured or die of carbon monoxide poisoning. And there's also just this stress. When you're in a hurricane zone, there can be a lot of stress. Say you have a generator and you know how to operate it, but 3 hours a day, you're going to the gas station, waiting in a long, long gas line to get gas for your generator. And people are cutting in the line. People are honking horns. It's a stressful situation. There can be a lot of mental and emotional stress and trials after a hurricane, not just physical trials. So that's what I really rank as number 10 there, this perspective that the day of the storm is the big challenge, when it's often the weeks and months after the storm that's a bigger challenge for people. The number 9 misunderstanding of hurricane impacts is misunderstanding hurricane return periods. Let me explain. A return period, when you hear that something's a 100-year storm, it means that on average, a storm of that magnitude or a flood level of that magnitude is only reached or exceeded on average every 100 years. Sometimes return periods are called return frequencies. A lot of times people really misunderstand what they mean. I was just in a hurricane workshop last week and someone said, hey, is it true that Hurricane Harvey was really a 100-year storm? I need to know because I want to know when we can expect the next one. So that concept of something being a 100-year storm, it's a great question. The part where she went off in her thinking was, if it was a 100-year storm and it happened 7 years ago, we have 93 more years till the next one. That's not how it works with return periods and return frequencies. A 100-year storm means that you have a 1% chance annually of having that occurrence. But when we look back at climate data sets, there's a lot of clustering. You may go 212 years and not have a 100-year storm, and then you may have 200-year storms in 5 years. That's the way it works a lot of times in the climate record. So really, again, you have a 1% chance annually of having a 100-year storm or reaching a 100-year flood level. That said, some of these clustering in the data sets, it's not just random. There are things called teleconnections, things like El Nino and La Nina. There are these climate patterns of pressure patterns and wind patterns and water temperature patterns, like the sea surface temperature in the Atlantic and the Pacific. That can shift you, making you a little bit more likely or less likely to get a hurricane impact in a given year. So it's not, if you're right on the line of having a 100-year storm, it's not like every year you have exactly a 1% chance. In a season like this upcoming season, you would have a little more than that because the waters in the Atlantic are exceptionally warm. We're moving into a La Nina in the Pacific. So you would bump that number up a little bit. But in general, when we think about return periods, it doesn't really matter what happened last year or the year before. Every year is new. And so the statistics kind of refresh as you move through time. The number 8 misunderstanding about hurricane impacts is a perspective: if I'm not in the flood zone, I cannot flood. I hear so many people say, I bought a house in South Florida, South Louisiana, coastal Texas, and my realtor said, I don't need flood insurance. What's implied there is you don't need flood insurance, you're not in the flood zone, and you're not going to flood. A lot of people think that they're not going to flood because they're not in FEMA's designated flood zone. What we see, though, especially in the last decade, is a lot of these really slow-moving hurricanes and tropical storms at landfall dumping tons of rain, both at the coast and inland. I mean, you look back to South Carolina in 2015, there was a storm named Joaquin that stalled out in the Bahamas. Rain was just streaming up into South Carolina in 2015, flooding a lot of people very far inland. 2016, we had South Louisiana, the hybrid storm that didn't have a name, over 30 inches of rain along the I-10 corridor. 2017, Hurricane Harvey, the wettest tropical cyclone in U.S. history, impacting so much of southeast Louisiana. 2018, Hurricane Florence, flooding the Carolinas with over 30 inches of rain and producing tremendous rainfall flooding and riverine flooding. Then 2019, back to southeast Texas, tropical storm Imelda. 2020, Hurricane Sally was only moving at 2 miles an hour when it made landfall near the Alabama-Florida border, dumping tremendous amounts of rain both at the coast and inland. This is time after time after time. We've seen a lot of these storms flooding areas that are way outside of the line of the 100-year flood zone. Take, for example, Hurricane Harvey in southeast Texas, 2017, Lamar University in Beaumont, Texas. They produced statistics that said 204,000 homes were damaged by Hurricane Harvey, and 75% of those homes were outside the 100-year floodplain. Just imagine that, a massive flood, one of the biggest floods in U.S. history, and 3/4 of the homes were outside the floodplain. So just because you do not live in the floodplain, It doesn't mean that you're safe from flooding. You still can flood. And in these big events like we've been having, we're seeing a lot of people flooding that are not in the floodplain. Misunderstanding number 7 about hurricane impacts is a perspective that the next storm will behave like the last one, or the last ones, if you've had a cluster of storms do something. I've seen this so many times that people have observed a hurricane track in the past, and they think the next storm is going to do the same thing. Classic example would be Hurricanes Rita and Ike in southeast Texas. So for context, Hurricane Katrina just absolutely devastated South Louisiana and coastal Mississippi, coastal Alabama in August of 2005. 3 weeks later, here comes a Cat 5 hurricane right for the Houston-Galveston corridor. There was this mass evacuation that was just complete mayhem, gridlock. The evacuation was actually incredibly fatal. So many people were stuck in gridlock for well over 12, 18, 20 hours, could not get out of Metro Houston. This was from Hurricane Rita in 2005. Well, as it turns out, Rita actually curved and did not produce a direct impact to the Houston-Galveston corridor at all. It made landfall near the Texas-Louisiana border. So all of a sudden, these hundreds of thousands of people that had a very bad experience, and in some cases, there were fatalities in the evacuation, people had a really bad experience and said, hey, I'm not doing that again. 3 years later, here comes Hurricane Ike, headed right for the Houston-Galveston corridor. A lot of those people said, hey, we're not going to be fooled again. Rita curved. Maybe Ike will curve too. They waited too long. They said, hey, Ike's coming in on a Friday night. If Ike's still coming on Friday morning, we're going to get up and leave. They woke up. It's Friday morning. Ike's still coming. Let's evacuate. Well, by now, their evacuation route is under 4 feet of water. So I believe there were 600 people airlifted off the Bolivar Peninsula that could not get out and were very much in harm's way. That was ground zero for the Hurricane Ike catastrophe. And so again, people looking back at Rita 3 years before and saying, hey, Rita curved, Ike will probably curve too. Every storm is different. The storm you're going to see impact your area next will be different than any storm you've seen before. The area of the country that concerns me the most with this is the west coast of Florida. Places like Tampa, Sarasota, Bradenton, Siesta Key, Venice. These areas have seen so many storms curve and miss them. And there's even a legend now that the ancient Indian burial grounds are protecting this area of the coast. They will never get a direct strike from a hurricane. Because when you go north of there, you think of storms like Hurricane Michael and Hurricane Ivan. When you go south of there, you think of Charlie and you think of Ian. But really, a direct hit on the Tampa metro area, they've been very lucky. But people are thinking, hey, these storms always curve because that's what they've seen in their life. Eventually, there's going to be one that doesn't curve, and it's going to be very catastrophic, unfortunately. So we cannot generalize. And the other thing people do is generalize a threat. If they have seen hurricane impacts in their area, they say, oh, this is what the wind damage will do. Oh, I've been here for a hurricane. The water will get up about a foot above the marina and maybe slightly cover the road because they've seen that twice. With a sample size of 2, they're now making vast generalizations. The next storm will be different. It might be parked. It might be a big rainmaker. It might be a big surge maker, or it might just blow up right before landfall and be a fast-moving small hurricane that's more of a windmaker. Every hurricane's different. Really have to pay attention to what the National Hurricane Center is saying, your trusted meteorologist, and really listen for the nuance. The forecast of what's coming may be very different from what you've seen in the past. Misunderstanding number 6 of hurricane impacts is this perception that really misunderstanding what you've experienced in previous hurricanes. I see this a lot. This is why it makes it up a little bit higher in the list, where people start talking about what they've experienced and they believe they've experienced hurricane conditions or even a Cat 2 or Cat 3 hurricane, but they really haven't. So I live in Galveston, Texas, here in southeast Texas, on a barrier island, very prone to hurricane impacts. Several years ago in 2021, Hurricane Nicholas became a hurricane just before making landfall along the central Texas coast near Matagorda Bay. Here in Galveston Island, I was out documenting it. We had some squalls and some rain bands move in. Some local people said, you're crazy, man. You're out there in a hurricane. You're filming this stuff on the seawall. I can't believe you're out there. I felt very comfortable. I've been in 18 hurricanes. I've documented a lot. I've been through even Category 4 winds. As I was out there filming this, I thought, this is a pretty cool storm, but it's a far cry even from a Cat 1 hurricane. It turns out, in retrospect, According to the NHC report, sustained winds from Hurricane Nicholas here in Galveston were 43 miles an hour with gusts to 62. So this was really a low-end tropical storm. And even if the winds were 30 miles an hour higher, it would not quite have been a hurricane. It was a far cry from being a hurricane. It was a cool storm. It was rainy and windy. I got a lot of good footage, but it definitely was not a hurricane. I couldn't believe over the following days, so many people calling their friends, calling their family, getting on social media saying, hey, that was my first hurricane. It wasn't that bad. Or, oh, hurricanes aren't really nearly as bad as I thought they'd be. And as I started engaging with people saying, you realize that those were sustained winds in the 40s. To have a hurricane, you need winds to exceed 74 miles an hour. So many people push back on that. And even one guy said, no, my app said that the winds were in the 70s here in Galveston. We had a hurricane. Here's the thing. I'm not really into debating or to arguing about semantics, but here's why that's really important. Imagine if people that go through a storm like that and they feel like they've endured a hurricane, but they really haven't. Now they actually live in a coastal community and they're actually expecting a Cat 2 hurricane to make landfall. They might say, oh, I've been through this before. It's not that big of a deal. And imagine the surprise when they're actually in a place with sustained winds of 100 miles an hour. They're going to say, okay, this is way beyond what I ever imagined. I'm concerned about slightly inland communities, Baton Rouge, Tallahassee, Orlando. This is where people will hear a category that hit the coast and they'll assume that applies to what their experience is. I lived in Baton Rouge for about 8 years. And when I just got there, Hurricane Gustav hit. Sustained winds at the airport in Baton Rouge, 61 miles an hour, gust to 91. Again, not quite a hurricane. Talk to people in Baton Rouge. They'll tell you they've been hit by a Cat 2 hurricane from Gustav, and they might even say a Cat 3 from Andrew back in 1992. So again, these inland places, they're hearing the category on the coast. They're transferring that to their experience. Hey, Gustav tore up Baton Rouge. It was a big impact. We lost electricity for 10 days, but it was not a hurricane. Sustained winds were in the low 60s. So that's my concern. And again, you have to realize really what the winds were where you are, and that changes from one location to another. It is very localized, and you can't just generalize what the highest category was in the coast. That may not match what you saw inland. And the big picture is you may not have seen anything nearly as devastating as you thought you saw. Hey, y'all, we made it to the top five misunderstandings of hurricane impacts. Number five on the list, thinking of hurricanes primarily as wind events. So in reality, flooding actually kills about 90% of people that die of direct impacts of hurricanes. But we often think of them not as flood events, but as wind events. I think there are two reasons we do this. Number one, a lot of the footage we see on the evening news, a lot of videos that are shot show palm trees blowing in the wind and ferocious winds blowing things away. It's easier and maybe more captivating to film that, but it's a lot harder to captivate storm surge washing away a house and survive the event. So I think a lot of people see hurricanes as wind events, and also our classification system. We classify hurricanes on a scale of 1 to 5 in the Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale. That tells you everything about the wind impact and the wind threat, but it does not really tell us much at all about the flood threat. So people tend to think of hurricanes as wind events a lot of times instead of flood events. It's really interesting when you look at the statistics. Rappaport's 2014 article and Rappaport and Blanchard's article in 2016 said that over a 50-year period, from 1963 to 2012, flooding was responsible for about 90% of hurricane fatalities. And the two biggest categories of that were storm surge, which killed about 50% of people, and rainfall flooding, which killed about 27%. There are some other categories as well, but the big two were storm surge and rainfall. And again, 90% of fatalities, but that may have shifted in recent years. NHC put out some research in August of 2023 saying over the past decade, this was from 2013 to 2022, 57% of fatalities in hurricanes were from rainfall flooding. That's right, 57% from rainfall flooding over the past decade. That's a big shift up for rainfall flooding. Why the change? Why the increase? I think there are two things maybe at play there. Number one, we've seen a lot of really slow-moving hurricanes that just park over the coast and actually spread these rain bands 40, 50, 60 miles inland. So we've seen a lot of flooding from rainfall, both most at the coast and inland. And also look at the development patterns along coastal areas and inland. We see a lot of suburban sprawl with a lot of parking lots and a lot of hard surfaces. We call those impervious surfaces that do not let water soak in. And so there's a lot more runoff than there used to be. These two factors may be leading to more deaths from rainfall. But keep in mind, flooding kills more people than wind and hurricanes. But people often think of hurricanes primarily as wind events. Okay, y'all, we're up to the top four misunderstandings on hurricane impacts. Number four on the list is that the eye is the most dangerous place in a hurricane. So when we think about this, and I do a lot of education with junior high and middle school students, and everyone knows the eye is calm. But think about this. You do have to pass through the dangerous eye wall. These bands of thunderstorms around the eye is called the eye wall. It's the most intense winds in a hurricane. So you do have to pass through that to get to the eye. But the eye itself is relatively calm. But when you talk to people, they'll say things like, wow, we got a direct hit from such and such hurricane. The eye came right over us. And it implies if the eye came over you, you saw the worst possible conditions. Typically, what happens is if you're to the right of the track, where you're in that right front quadrant, you'll see often heavier rainfall, but that's also where you'll get the stronger winds and usually the higher storm surge as well. So your worst case scenario is typically not the eye coming right over your location. It would be the eye offset, where you're really in the strongest part of the hurricane with the biggest storm surge and the strongest winds without a break. You stay in that right front quadrant eye wall. And so it may look on a map like the storm just missed you, but actually you got the worst of it. Good example, I keep coming back often to examples in Southeast Texas where I live. Hurricane Ike actually came right over Galveston Island. And a lot of Galvestonians will say, yeah, it was a worst case scenario. It actually wasn't. The worst conditions were offset just to the northeast. Bolivar Peninsula, just miles east of the eye wall, just got hammered and obliterated. Just everything was completely washed away, complete catastrophe. And it would have been worse for Galveston Island if Ike actually made landfall about 20 miles farther west. We would not have had a direct eye passage, but storm surge probably would have been 4 or 5 feet higher and a lot more devastation. I'm ranking the number three misunderstanding of hurricane impacts as people thinking of the cone of uncertainty as an impacts cone. So as we know, when there's a hurricane forecast, the National Hurricane Center will put out this cone of uncertainty. That's really a cone of where they think the eye is most likely to go. And people often assume that that's an impacts cone. So they think if they're in the cone of uncertainty, they're in danger. But if they're outside the cone, they're not in danger. I had a conversation with Carl Parker, meteorologist from the Weather Channel. You can check out GeoTrek Podcast 91. And he talked about the cone is not an impacts cone. You can be outside the cone of uncertainty and still see really life-threatening conditions. Great example of this would be Hurricane Ian in 2022, making landfall in Southwest Florida. Ian took a track really near the right edge of that cone, but a lot of the deadly impacts were to the right of that and really outside the cone. So places like Fort Myers Beach and even down towards Naples, you saw life-threatening conditions, but some of those areas were outside the cone of uncertainty. Again, you can see deadly impacts outside the cone. The cone is just saying where the eye is most likely to track. Typically, the most deadly impacts will be to the right of that track for storm surge, rainfall, flooding, and the strongest winds. And so do not think of the cone as an impacts cone. Really look at the impact separately. Where's the wind likely to impact? Where is the flood likely to impact? That'll give you a better perception of what you can expect from the storm in your area. Well, here we are at the top two misunderstandings on hurricane impacts. These two things are so misunderstood and blindside so many people, putting their lives at risk. If we just had a better understanding of these two things, we would save a lot of lives. Number two for me is considering or perceiving hurricanes to be points and hurricane tracks to be lines. This happens so much when there's a hurricane out there, we hear where the center of circulation is. And we talk about the coordinates. You even have these hurricane tracking maps. And that's great for kids to get used to plotting things for latitude and longitude. And we see where it is in the map and we put the little hurricane symbol as a point. And then we talk about the track. We talk about where it's going and we see all these different lines, right? We talk about the spaghetti plots and all these different models are suggesting where it's going to go. But each of those model runs is depicted on the map as a line. A line is just geometrically, right, a connection of points. So we get this idea in our head that hurricanes are really just points. And this comes out a lot in the language. Like people will say, oh, I saw that this storm hit Mobile, or this, I saw that this hurricane hit Fort Myers, and they'll mention one city, like, or I saw that the storm hit 30 miles west of you, as if it's a point. Keep in mind that hurricanes are actually really broad areas of devastating wind and flood impacts that can impact hundreds of miles. So when you hear of people saying things like, oh, it looks like it's going to miss us 30 miles to the west, they're talking about it as if it's a point. Again, there's a broad wind field, there's a broad flood zone, and people often don't think of hurricanes in those terms. Great story that comes to mind. One of my closest friends, Jonathan Brazell with the National Weather Service in Lake Charles, does an amazing job. He's just so dedicated and such a clear mind with weather forecasting and communication. He was talking when Hurricane Ike was barreling towards a Galveston landfall. He works in South Louisiana, and he was talking to stakeholders there in coastal South Louisiana, talking about 10 to 12 or more feet of storm surge. And people started saying, hang on a second. You mean to say a Cat 2 hurricane making landfall in Galveston is going to put 12 feet of water into south central Louisiana, 150 miles to the east? And he said, that's exactly what I'm saying. And they just had trouble believing, how in the world can a storm making landfall in another state flood us so bad in South Louisiana? As we know, that's exactly what played out. And so again, these, especially these geographically huge storms, Katrina's, the Ikes, Superstorm Sandy, Hurricane Isaac in 2012, a lot of these really large geographic storms are going to flood hundreds of miles of coastline, and the wind fields are tremendous. And I think that blindsides a lot of people that are thinking of hurricanes as points and thinking of hurricane tracks as lines. So again, it really helps to, and this season I'm going to be doing a lot of impact forecasting where I'm looking at the impacts of wind, the impacts of water, getting away from the cone of uncertainty and really looking at the broad reach of these hurricane impacts. Well, here we are, y'all. I think we're going to need a drum roll for this. We're at the number one misunderstanding on hurricane impacts. This may not surprise you. I thought all along this was going to be my number one on the list. It's really perceiving that the hurricane category, the Saffir-Simpson hurricane category, determines the threat. You hear this so much. People say, hey, we only evacuate for category 3 or higher. People really taking that category number and making an assessment that all of their risk is tied up into that number. We've actually used to do this more before Hurricane Ike. With Hurricane Katrina's and Ike and some of these other large geographic storms, Ike again completely obliterated the Bolivar Peninsula. On a scale of 1 to 5, it was a Cat 2. Maximum sustained winds around 110, just below Cat 3, but a lot of people said we don't evacuate for Cat 2s. Their whole neighborhood was wiped off the face of the earth. And so we've learned over time that we cannot assess a hurricane's threat based on the Saffir-Simpson category, but that's still how a lot of people think of it and talk about it. Again, I'm giving you a lot of examples from where I live in Galveston. You can go to Tequila's restaurant on Post Office Street in downtown Galveston, and there are the high water marks from 5 hurricanes. What I think is interesting in that part of the island, Ike is actually the highest on that wall. And that has to do, the 1900 storm had this big wall of debris around downtown. On the island as a whole, the 1900 storm, the deadliest disaster in U.S. history, actually produced a higher storm surge, 15.7 feet. But in that part of town, it was shielded and actually has a lower high water mark there than Ike. So Ike is the highest, Cat 2. The lowest on that column, there's a column there with 5 high water marks. The lowest high water mark on that column is from Alicia. Category 3 hurricane in 1983. Listen to these numbers closely. A Category 3 with a low surge, and then the highest was a Category 2 with a high surge. Like they say, there's more to the story than the category. And a lot of people get killed by thinking the higher the category, the worse the threat. And this actually comes from the meteorological community as well. When I was in Hurricane Florence in 2018, I'm on the ground in North Carolina, and they're expecting Florence to stall out with 30 plus inches of rain over a 3 to 4 day period. I couldn't believe the meteorologists on air were saying, hey, the storm has now been downgraded. It's no longer a hurricane, it's a tropical storm. When most people hear downgraded, that sounds like the threat has reduced. And so it puts us, as a science communicator, as a hurricane communicator, it puts us into a hole that we have to dig ourselves out of using a lot of all those statements. Although it's been quote unquote downgraded, your 30 inches of rain has just begun. And in some areas near rivers, you're going to see water up to the eaves of houses. But it's been called downgraded because the category dropped. So that's, I think, the number one misunderstanding. Wow. again, keep in mind, flooding kills a lot more people than wind. And a lot of times we talk about downgraded or it weakened, and we're giving the indication that the threat has reduced, and it hasn't. It's interesting. After Hurricane Ike 2008, the National Hurricane Center dissociated storm surge levels from the Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale. And that was a move in the right direction for sure. But still, even this past weekend, I went on the web, I went to the NHC storm surge risk maps. You can pull up storm surge risk maps for the whole coastal area. And again, it's based on category. A category 3, you see more flood risk than a category 2. Keep in mind, when you have those types of risk maps, as far as my understanding with this, the NHC will take category 2 hurricanes and they'll run thousands of model runs. And what you're seeing on that map is the worst case of all of the possible Cat 2s. And then you switch to the worst case of all the possible Cat 3s and the worst case of all the thousands of possible Cat 4s. They change the track, they change the forward speed, they change all these parameters of the hurricane. And so you're seeing really the worst of the worst. And if you look into it, this gets into what the NHC with the SLOSH model calls a maximum envelope of water, or the MEOW. And then really those can be compiled into the maximum of maximums, or the MOMs. But you're seeing the worst of the worst cases. But in those tools, each category shows higher level flooding. In real life, what you might see in your neighborhood is a Cat 2 produces more storm surge flooding than a Cat 4. And again, this has to do with the size of the storm, the forward speed, the angle of approach. So it's very dangerous to start linking these things. And still today, it's implied that the higher the category, the worse all the hazards are. And that's just not true. That's why I put that at the number one threat. A lot of people stay for a Cat 1 or stay for a Cat 2, and suddenly they're drowning in their houses. Because like we saw in coastal Mississippi, Katrina flooded houses that Camille did not. And you had a Cat 3 at landfall flooding houses that were not flooded from a Cat 5 at landfall. And to a lot of people, that doesn't make sense. If my house didn't flood in a Cat 5, how is it flooding in a Cat 3? Well, you know, there's different reasons to that. Katrina was geographically huge. And the pre-landfall winds, if you get out 18 hours before landfall, Camille and Katrina were only 11 knots different. They were comparable storms pre-landfall, but Katrina was so much huger. And we know that pre-landfall wind also impacts hurricane storm surge at the coast. Anyway, going a little bit long with this one, but because it's so important, there's more to the story than the category. You really have to consider all hazards, your rainfall flooding, your storm surge flooding, and your wind impacts, as well as isolated tornado threat as well. You have to look at all of those separately. Don't just look at the eye. Don't just look at the line of the track, and certainly look at more than the category of the storm. Well, hey, y'all, that wraps up our top 10 list. Hope you enjoyed it. And if you have any comments or concerns, any feedback on that, let us know. We're all over social media with GeoTrack. You can also reach out to me directly at Hurricane Hal. I'm going to be doing a lot of impact-based hurricane forecasting this season. What does that mean, impact-based forecasting? Well, what I noticed from spending time in disaster zones is that really what most people are concerned about is my house going to flood? If so, when? And is my house likely to take wind damage? And if so, when? That's what people are concerned about. I feel like we have a lot of peripheral products out there and graphics that are distracting people from the main message. It doesn't matter if your house is inside or outside the cone. What matters is the likeliness that you're going to see flooding, the likeliness you're going to see wind damage. And so imagine that you're outside the cone, but there are NHC, National Hurricane Center, products that show there's now a 60% chance that your neighborhood is going to see at least 4 feet of storm surge above ground level. What does it matter if you're in the cone or not? What matters is looking at the likeliness of flooding and the likeliness of wind damage. That's what I'm going to be focusing on in my hurricane forecast this year. I call it impact-based forecasting. I'm going to lead with that. And then, hey, if it's a few minutes into the forecast and you're still interested to talk about the track and wind shear and the pressure and all these other things, we'll be talking about that as well. I also use a lot of common language. So, for example, unlikely, possible, probable, and likely. So if your flood risk in your neighborhood just increased from 40 to 60%, I'm going to say you just went from possible to probable. People know probable means it's more than 50%. I'm going to use very common language with that as well. Again, considering these perceptions, these misunderstandings. I'm going to try to really focus on the impacts, try to get away from the center of circulation, the eye, the cone, and really talk about the hazards, the flooding and the wind where you live. What's the likeliness? We're going to lead with that this year on our forecast. You can see us. We always do a lot of social media on CNC Catastrophe and National Claims page, also the GeoTrack page, and a lot of our social media. You're going to see a lot of forecasts during this active hurricane season, and we're taking into consideration these misunderstandings that people have. We're trying to hit people where they are, and I'm going to say this one last thing from about 15 years now of spending time in hurricane disaster zones and spending a lot of time with a cross-section of society. If I could sum up the people I meet and their retirees, their restaurant waiters and waitresses, their veterinarians, their school teachers, if I could have one word to sum up the people I meet, it's busy. Everyone's really, really busy. They may only have a minute or two to listen to your forecast. So if you start off talking about center of circulation and wind shear and all these things going out in the Bahamas, they may only have 30 seconds to listen. So I'm going to be leading with the impacts this year, saying this is what you can expect in your communities from flood and wind. Talk about that. Talk about the likeliness. And then, hey, if it's 2-3 minutes in, you're still listening to my broadcast, we can talk about some of the bigger picture of what's impacting the track, how certain we are in this forecast or how uncertain, things like that will follow up. But always love to hear from you. We try to critique and have a very targeted forecast based on what we're hearing from the public, based on what we're hearing from our loyal listeners. So if you have opinions about this, hit us up. Let us know how we can improve not only our forecasting, but even more importantly, our forecast communication. So much is lost in communication. We're trying to get past these misunderstandings so that we can communicate better to help save lives and help save properties. Well, everyone, thanks so much for tuning in. Always great to touch base with you. Again, we're less than a month away from the start of hurricane season, so this is a time to prepare. We're gonna see what happens, but we're expecting an active season up ahead. Everyone, have a great time. We'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrack Podcast.